It's surprisingly unremarked in the media at the moment, but as we speak, the Australian and East Timorese governments are locked in talks at the Permanent Court of Arbitration at The Hague. And at issue, who owns the $50 billion oil field in the sea, known as Greater Sunrise. The talks are non-binding. Sounds like the plebiscite. And Australia had to be dragged there kicking and screaming. But the hope is that they will make some headway towards settling who owns the damned oil. Kim McGrath spent the last decade working with former Victorian Premier Steve Bracks as a governance advisor to the East Timorese government. And while there, Kim's discomfort over Australia's dealings over the oil issue grew, and she started digging deeper, pouring through thousands of Australian government documents. And what she discovered sheds new light on our duplicitous dealings with that newly born nation. And Kim has written a book called Crossing the Line, Australia's Secret History in the Timor Sea. Joins me now. Kim, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Philip.
East Timor, 40 times since that first visit with Steve 10 years ago. It has changed immensely, hasn't it?
Oh, amazingly. When we first landed in September 2007, there were 100,000 people living in ODP camps all around Dili. It felt like you were sort of going into a war zone. And remarking it now, that it's just been transformed. It's a bustling, you know, crazy Asian city. You used to be able to get anywhere in Dili in 10 minutes. Now it takes, there's just massive traffic jams and chaos. And it's been a remarkable transformation.
Well, and from at one stage, people are saying failed state, and now the Economist's Global Democracy Survey ranks it first in Southeast Asia.
Yep, it is an incredible success story, and one that is, you know, generally the only stories we hear in the Australian media are very negative, and yet a little sort of miracle occurred on our doorstep in terms of a new country setting up, having to develop a whole new system of government and establish a democratic system. They've had a series of democratic elections that have been non-violent. And there's, incredible, progress.
Okay, before we get into what's happening in The Hague, remind listeners what the Timor Gap is.
Okay, it's a long story, but I'll try and give you the short version. The Timor Sea separates Australia and Timor, and Timor-Leste, as East Timor has been known since independence, is the eastern half of the island of Timor. The other half of the island is Indonesian. And in the Timor Sea, between Australia and Indonesia and Timor, there's a lot of oil and gas. And most of it is on the northern side of the halfway line, sort of the median line. And in the early 70s, Australia negotiated a treaty with Indonesia, refused to negotiate with Portugal, which was Timor was a Portuguese colony. And the treaty Australia negotiated with Indonesia was very favourable to Australia, pushed the boundary line up much closer to Indonesia than Australia. And there was a gap left between Portuguese Timor and Australia. And that became known as the Timor Gap.
Is that in any way distinguished from the Timor Trough?
The Timor Trough, isn't it? The Timor Trough became Australia's argument for why it was able to claim these areas north of the median line, because common sense sort of suggests, and now certainly international law makes it clear that in the situation that is in the Timor Sea, you'd have a median line would normally be the boundary. The Timor Trough is a dent in Australia's continental shelf that's about 30 to 40 miles off the coast of Timor, sort of runs parallel to the coast. And Australia in the 1960s and 70s and right up to today maintains that the Timor Trough marks the end of Australia's continental shelf, and therefore, under old international law, when there was law relating to continental shelf rights, Australia could therefore issue permits, exploration permits, up to this Timor Trough. Geologists have always disputed that, and Indonesia certainly disputed that at the time, and so did Portugal. And one of the interesting documents I came across in the archives was dated from February 1970, and it was a report from the Australian Bureau of Mineral Resources, and it was just a little two-page document about headed the Timor Trough, and it concluded that the Timor Trough, there was no evidence that the Timor Trough marked the edge of Australia's continental shelf. And it was, that was one of those documents I read in the archives and went, that seems to be, would have been explosive advice at the time, because it was totally contradicted Australia's position. And yet Australia went into the negotiations with Indonesia completely ignoring that advice and disputing Indonesia's claims on that issue. And Australia to this day still maintains that the it's got rights to the Timor Trough, which is geologists now, there is consensus that the trough is just a dint in the continental shelf, and the continental shelf extends beneath the island of Timor, and therefore international law is that you split the difference, and that should be, you know, the median line should apply.
Let's walk this back to Portugal granting East Timor independence in 1974. This was an area in which I remember Gough Whitlam was always got very agitated if you began to discuss it. Immediately, Indonesia invades. Now, why, in your view, is Australia the only Western nation that actually recognised Indonesia's sovereignty over East Timor?
That's a very good question. That's one of the questions that sent me sort of down this pathway. One of the things that's been written out of Australia's official histories of this period and the Indonesian invasion is that in the years before the invasion in December 1975, Portugal and Australia were involved in a full-blown diplomatic dispute about the right to issue permits. And Portugal had actually issued a permit to an American company to the median line that overlapped permits Australia had issued. And Australia believed that, and there's evidence in the archives that shows this, that if Indonesia took over East Timor, it would be, Indonesia would agree to simply close the Timor gap by just drawing a straight line that would put all the oil and gas areas on Australia's side of the line.
Let's remind the listener that here's an issue where Whitlam was, in fact, pro-Indonesian. He'd been a big Indonesian supporter. It wasn't just the Libs.
No, absolutely not. But a lot of people, Whitlam is sort of notorious for having gone sort of way beyond the line, over the line, in terms of his support for the Indonesian invasion. But what is less talked about is that by the time Indonesia invaded, Whitlam had already been dismissed in November. And it was Peacock was the foreign minister and Fraser was the was prime minister. And it was Fraser and Peacock who, to sort of come back to your earlier question about why did Australia become the only country to recognise Indonesia's occupation, after the invasion, Indonesia surprised the Australian gurus in the department and refused to just draw a straight line. And instead, there was this long drawn out sort of diplomatic tug of war between Australia and East Timor, with Indonesia desperately wanting Australia to recognise its occupation, because Indonesia saw that that would give them some cover in the UN and it might help sway other countries, because there was at the United Nations, Portugal was still considered the authority in East Timor. But Australia was under the Fraser and Peacock, and the government were under enormous pressure from the oil companies that had been issued these permits to provide them the certainty that they needed to invest the millions and millions of dollars that they needed to start operating the oil and gas fields.
I thought I knew a lot about what happened in Indonesia and East Timor, but you have found so much material. We should remind the listener that after the invasion, 200,000 people, that's one third of the population, died. There was famine, rapes, tortures. It was a horrific war. And you have found material that the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade knew much more about what was going on, particularly the famine, than they let on at the time.
That was one of the things that just horrified me when I was reading this material in the archives, that our officials in Canberra were getting briefs from, or they were getting intelligence from the usual, you know, intelligence sources, but there were also whistleblowers and people smuggling stories out from East Timor, including, you know, lists of people that have been killed and reports of horrible atrocities. But because the political situation here in Australia was, there was still a lot of concern, and you'd remember still an opposition to the Indonesian invasion, which made it very difficult for the government to turn around and start negotiating to close the Timor gap. So the Australian officials tried to kill stories getting into the Australian media about what was going on in Timor in order to create a sort of domestic political environment where it would be tenable to recognise the occupation. Because they were caught in a catch-22 situation there, that to start to negotiate with Indonesia to close the Timor gap to provide the certainty that the oil companies were demanding necessarily involved recognising Indonesia's sovereignty over East Timor. And so they couldn't do it secretly, which I think they would have liked to have been able to do, or done a sort of nod and a wink deal, because that's also involved recognition. And that's, I mean, in the past people have said, oh, we recognised the occupation because we wanted to appease Indonesia. But that's a pretty meaningless phrase. And there was the documents I've found, and there's a particular cabinet submission from the one that Peacock took to cabinet that warped into cabinet, bypassed all the normal processes because they were so paranoid about leaks. And there's still big sections of that redacted, but from the material that's not redacted, it's explicit that cabinet at that same meeting that decided to recognise Indonesia's sovereignty also decided to start negotiating to close the Timor gap.
Now, John Howard says that Australia's intervention in East Timor, when East Timor declares independence, was one of his proudest achievements, but you point out that his support for East Timor only came after the resistance leader, Xanana Gusmao, publicly agreed to honour the Timor Gap Treaty.
Yes, that's another story that's sort of been rewritten various documents put out by the Department of Foreign Affairs that suggest that, yeah, and a part of the Australian mythology is that we were heroes when we went in East in 99. But what is, if you drill down a bit, it's clear that Downer and Howard certainly weren't supporting independence. They were supporting autonomy within Indonesia, because the last thing Australia wanted at that time was for suddenly to have an independent East Timor, because that would have meant the Timor Gap Treaty that they'd spent decades filing and negotiating with Indonesia after independence. And that was the notorious one where Gareth Evans and Ali Alatas were drinking champagne in the jet flying over the Timor Sea. That would have unravelled. And by 1999, Australia had signed up to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea in 1994. And under that convention, again, it's explicit that in circumstances where, well, that convention provides that every coastal country has a right to a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone where they've got rights to oil and gas and fisheries and everything else. And where there are zones that overlap, which is the case in the Timor Sea, the median line applies. So in 1999, Australia had, once Indonesia pulled out and that treaty became void, Australia under international law had no rights at all beyond the median line. And yet we somehow managed to succeed in bullying the United Nations that was administering East Timor from 1999 to 2002, and then certainly the new government, into continuing to give Australia rights north of the median line. This is at a time when the country, you know, it had just been completely destroyed by Indonesia retreating. And as you said, 200,000 people had died. They were traumatised. They had no international advice. It was just appalling what we did.
And it's still appalling what we're doing. Effectively now, the only thing left for East Timor was to force Australia into the conciliation process that's underway at The Hague. And, of course, we fought against that for a hell of a long time.
Yeah, and we allegedly, you know, the allegations of spying on the treaty negotiations. And it all makes it. So Australia's conduct really only makes sense when you factor in that we're talking about billions of dollars worth of oil and gas, and billions of dollars that has been written out of Australia's history of that period. I mean, that was one of the things that frustrated me most. Was there was a there've been quite a number of publications put out by the Department of Foreign Affairs that supposedly tell the truth about what happened and are meant to be informing the Australian public about what really went on, but they have all written out the fact that billions of dollars were at stake.
What's your feeling about how the conciliation will go? Timor's been dudded such a long time. Are you confident they'll do well?
Xanana Gusmão is an extraordinary leader and tactician and strategist. And he's proved he's, you know, capable of the long game. But I don't know. I just having seen sort of firsthand the way Australia's conducted its foreign affairs around this issue over the last half century, there's going to be drag kicking and screaming. I'm probably a bit cynical, but. We'll have to wait and see.
Does the Labor Party have a distinct policy position on this these days? And if so, does it differ from the Libs?
Yes. At the just before the last federal election, the Labor Party changed its policy to agree to immediately enter negotiations. And if those negotiations failed to reach an outcome, allow an international umpire to make a decision, which, you know, but for one vote, the last election, that could have, or one seat, that, you know, that could be all happening now, which is a, you know, that's another avenue of hope.
Well, let us hope together that something better comes out of it, because it's a country that deserves to have a decent future, and we should be doing everything we can to help, not make things worse. Kim, good on you. Kim McGrath's book is called Crossing the Line, Australia's Secret History in the Timor Sea, published by Redback.